Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Tzadi Amun Aleph, 12 lines down. Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef, Lo Shanu Elo Kodoshim and Nechalim. The statement that we have now determined that Gidon Asheh applies to Mukdashim is only true with regards to Kodoshim that are eaten, like a Shlamim, an Asham, a Chatat. Aval Kodoshim She'enam Nechalim, when it comes to Kodoshim that are not eaten, like an Olah, Ein Iser Gid Nuheg Behen. There's no din of git and nasheh with regards to them. But Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan disagrees and says, Echad kodeshim anechalim, echad kodeshim she'en anechalim, iser git noheg ben. Doesn't matter whether you're a korban that is eaten, whether you're a korban that goes in its entirety on the mizbeach, git and nasheh has relevance to those korbanot. Amar Papa delo plige. They really don't argue. Kan lahal koto. Kan lahaloto. Depends on what you're speaking about. We'll read it with Rashi's view first. Rashi says, kan halkoto, loki imachalo. That you get malkot if you eat such a gidon asheh. So with regards to that, Rabbi Yochanan says it makes no difference if you eat the gidon asheh of a korban that is eaten, or the gidon asheh of a korban that's not eaten, you're gonna get malkot. Kan lahaloto. The other tzad is that putting it on the mizbeach is not gonna result in you getting malkot, because that's not called achila. Even though the mizbeach, we know there's something called achilat ha-mizbeach, but there's no restriction against the mizbeach eating the gidon asheh. And therefore, Rabbi Yochanan's statement references to the malkot, that you will get malkot for eating it. And the haloto is the reference of Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef's statement, that there's no restriction against putting it on the mizbeach, even though there are those that believe that there might still be an isur. If you look at the Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, he explains it in the following manner. Mish ochlo, someone who eats it, keman shein ra'oi l'achila, ein chayav malkot. Because it's not ra'oi l'achila, you don't get malkot for it. Aval isura of it, but you are in violation of an isur. There's a third view in the Ran, that here it's referencing to putting something on the mizbeach that will not result in malkot, but
so even though you're not going to get malkot, there is an isur because of mashke Yisrael, that you can only put something that's mutar on the mizbeach. But it's the lack of malkot over here, as opposed to Rashi, who says there are malkot for the person who eats it.
Aval lahaloto gabi mizbeach, to put on the mizbeach, lahaktiro gidon asheh, noheg behen, dein maktirinoto, because you don't put it on. So he has it just the opposite of what Rashi has it. Says with regards to malkot, there's no malkot over here, because it's not ra'oi l'achila. There's going to be no malkot for it, but there's still an Easter that remains here. You're not supposed to eat it. But if you do eat it, you're not going to get malkot for it. Although, to put it on the mizbeach, that din of gidon asheh is no egg ban, and you can't put it on the mizbeach. Which means that Rabbi Yochanan's statement is referencing to haloto, putting on the mizbeach, which would be improper, versus the statement of Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef, which we're referencing to the malkot, that you're not going to get malkot for eating it because it's not ra'ui le'achila, it's not something that's within the world of achila. Ikadamre, there's an alternative view over here, Amar Papa velo plige. There's no machloket here. Kan lechalotzo, kan lehaloto. It's a question about what you need to do with it. Do you need to remove the gidon asheh from the yerech? That would be lechalotzo. As far as that is concerned, Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef says that there's no necessity for that. You don't have to remove the gidon asheh. The other tzad is lehaloto, which is that you're not allowed to put it on by itself. If it's not subsumed in the Yerech, then you can't put it on, and that's what Rabbi Yochanan's statement was referring to. Rabbi Chiya Bar Yosef tells you, if it's within the Yerech, just put it on the Mizbeach, you don't have to be choletz, you don't have to remove it. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan's speaking about whether it's alone, when it's already pulled out of the Yerech, that you don't put it on the Mizbeach. But in that way, they're not arguing, they're in full agreement, just a question of what they're addressing. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Amar Laloto Plige. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom says it is, that Rav Nachman Yitzchak Amar Laloto Plige, Klomar Afilu Lahaloto Plige. Even on Ha'ala, they are arguing, Demand Amar Ein Gidon Asheh Noheg Ben, Malino Tolaktir. According to one who says that Ein Gidon Asheh Noheg Ben, which is Rav Chiya Bar Yosef, Malino Tolaktir. You can put it on the Mizbeach. It's not clear from the Rabbeinu Gershom, is what's the scenario. Does that mean when it's alone, you can put it on? Or does that mean subsumed in the Yerech that you can put it on? Rashi, interestingly enough, has a different girsa. Rav Nachman Yitzchak Amar lechalatzo plige, that they argue about chalitza. Demand Amar noheg kasaver mitzvah lechalotzo. Rabbi Yochanan, who says that there is a din of gidon asheh, says you got to pull it out before you put it on the mizbeach. Ulalishna kama, And then Rashi says, well, according to the first Lashon and Rav Papa, then it's Lahaloto Plige. Then they even argue about the Haloto. The one who says that it applies, meaning Rabbi Yochanan thinks that you can't put on the Mizbeach with the Yerech. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says that they even argue about the Haloto. And the one who says, in Gineh Noshebehem, you put on the Mizbeach, it's not clear what he means. You can put it on even without being inside the Yerech. Rashi says that, according to the second Lashon, they're arguing in the Chalatzo. Rabbi Yochanan requires that you remove it, whereas Rabbi Chir Bar Yosef does not require that you remove it. And according to the first Lashon, they're arguing about Laloto, whether when it's subsumed in the Yerech, are you allowed to put it on the Mizbeach, or are you not allowed to put it on the Mizbeach? And that's similar to a machloket between Rabbi and the Rabbanon, which we're going to see in a moment to Daniel. Biktira koin et akol ha-mizbecha. When it comes to the Olah, it says that you need to put everything on the Mizbeach. Lirabot, that includes Atzamot, Hagidim, Barkornayim, Valtalpayim. It includes the bones. Here the Gidim we're speaking about are the Gidim of Heter, ones that you could eat, that are edible Gidim that can go on the Mizbeach. Karnayim, the horns, Valtalpayim, and the hoofs. Everything goes on the Mizbeach. That's what Hakol tells you. Yochal Afilu Parshu, you would think even if they separated away from the Olah, then you'd put them on the Mizbeach. Tamalomar vasita olotecha habasar vadam. There it sounds like the olot only require the basar and dam to go on the mizbeach, not these other ancillary parts. Ibasar vadam. So if you think only basar vadam can go on, yachol yacholot gidim v'atzamot, you would have to then remove the gidim and atzamot in order to put on mizbeach. Ve'ale basar legabe mizbeach, and then you put on just the flesh on the mizbeach. Tamalomar v'ktira kohen etakol hamizbecha. That you put everything on the Mizbeach. So you have a tension here between kol, which is everything going on, and basar v'dam. How do I reconcile that? Haketzat. Michubarim ya'alu. If they remain attached to the basar, then they go on the Mizbeach. Pershu afilu birosh ha-mizbeach yirdu. If they separate away from the basar, even on the top of the Mizbeach, before they get on the Mizbeach, they come back down, they don't go on by themselves. And obviously, you can formulate this in many different ways, as to why the Atzamot, Gidim, and Talfaim and Karnaim go on the Mizbeach, are they then considered like Basar because they're attached to the Basar? Or are they considered to be just ancillary to the Basar? Once the Basar is going on, they're Batel to the Basar and they go on with the Basar? Or is it just a matter of convenience? Meaning that we're not going to force you to peel the Basar off, we're just going to put it on as an entity. But if they do separate away, we're not going to let you. So you could formulate it in any one of those ways. The Gemara says, Mantana dishmaitle damar pershu yerdu. Who is the one who says that if they separate away, that you take them down and they don't go on the Mizbeach? Rabihi. It's that braita we just read was authored by Rabbi Tanya. Because we have another braita. V'yiktir ha-kohenet ha-kol, ravot ha-tzamot ha-gidim ha-karnayim ha-talfayim. Similar to the previous braita. Hayakol means everything, including all of these other items that are not basar v'dam. Vafilu pershu, and even if they separated away. Vaha mani mikayem vasita olutecha basar v'dam. So then what do I do with the pasuk of basar v'dam, which makes it sound like only the basar v'dam go on, not all of these other items. Vipokim, with things that flew off the mizbeach. Things that were already on the pyre, and then popped off the pyre. Ha ketzat. So how do you formulate that, articulate that? Ikulei basar ata machzir. If you have basar that's already consumed by the flame, that's been on the fire and on the pyre, if it pops off, you got to put it back on. V'ata machzir ikulei gidim v'atzamot. What you don't have to do is replace those things that are secondary ancillary to the basar. You do not have to replace those on the mizbeach if they popped off the mizbeach. So that means v'yiktir hakol means whether they are attached, whether they are separated, you put them on the Mizbeach. Everything goes on the Mizbeach. But where is the exception where Basar Vadam are different? That's only if they were already on the pyre and they popped off. Is there an obligation, even when they've been consumed or been in the fire, to put them back on? By Basar, the answer is yes. By these items, the answer is no. That's the view of the Chachamim. Rabbi Omer, and now Rabbi has the opinion that we saw in the previous Braita, which is why the Gemara says this is Rabbi's opinion. Ketuv Echad Omer V'Yiktir HaKohen Et HaKol. He puts everything on. Riba. That's an inclusionary term. There is a miut then in that pasuk which says basar v'dam, yes, everything else, no. Haket said, how do I reconcile between the ribui and the miut? If they're still attached, they go on the mizbeach. Pershu, if they separate away, then they go back down. That's Rabbi's opinion, which matches up to the previous braita that we brought. So now the Gemara continues. Virabonon mechubarim lo itzrikra. If it's already attached, you don't need a posuk liribuye to include it. Mita dehava arosha shel ola. No different than the head of an ola, because the head of the ola goes on the mizbeach, because it says bet arosh. You put the head on the mizbeach. Now in the head are subsumed atzamot and all sorts of other things. Sear, karnayim, all that stuff's in the head. So that already teaches you that items that are attached go on to the mizbeach, irrespective of whether they are basar v'dam. So then why do you need a pasuk to include certain things? The pershu, to say, even if they separate away, you still put them on the mizbeach. Rabbi, mechubarim dehetera, lo, tzeri itztrichra lerebuye. You're right, when it comes to things that are attached, that are of het there you don't need a pasuk to include them. They're like the rosh, and they go on the mizbeach. Ki itztrichra, the gidin asheh bemechubar. What you need the pasuk for is when you have a gidin asheh that's attached, that you need a pasuk to tell you that it goes on the mizbeach. So what you see from Rabbi's position now is that if the gidin asher is subsumed in the erech, it goes on the mizbeach. That's what the pasuk's teaching you, that those things that are mechubar go on the mizbeach. Mechubar de hetera, I don't need a pasuk for that. That goes on the mizbeach, irrespective, that we learned from the rosh. But mechubar, that's isur, that I can't learn from the pasuk, because that's not obvious that it goes on. That's what the ribuy comes to teach you. Even mechubarim of isur are going to go on the mizbeach. That means a gid and asher that's subsumed in a yerech is going on the mizbeach. The rabbonon, on the other hand, say that the point of the ribuy over here is clearly not to teach you about mechubarim that we get from rosh. So then, what are we learning from this? That even if they separate away, they have to go on the mizbeach. The varim shel heter that separate away, they go to mizbeach. What about gid and asher for them? Rabbonon mimashke Yisrael. Mina mutar li Israel. Imashke Israel is a pasuk in Yechezkel, which says, Se'achad minatzon. Mina mataim mimashke Israel. And it's speaking about there about the korbanot and the nisachim. And the Gemara darshins from mimashke Israel, only things that are mutarim to Israel can go on the mizbeach. The mizbeach can only eat things that we could otherwise eat. If we can't eat it, the mizbeach can't eat it. And so therefore, gidin asher, which Bnei Yisrael can't eat, can't go on the mizbeach. So according to the Chachamim, you're not permitted to put the Gidon Asher on the Mizbeach, even if it is subsumed in the Yerech. Even if it is inside of the Yerech, it cannot go on the Mizbeach. So for them, things that are het there, you know that go on the Mizbeach from the Rosh. That tells you already that things that are Mechubar go on the Mizbeach. Things of Isur that are Mechubar, how do you know that? I don't need to know that. That's not going on the Mizbeach, according to them. So then what's the Riboy come to teach you? Akol. Kol tells you that even when they separate away, you still put them on the Mizbeach. Rabbi, mide dehava chelev v'dam. Rabbi says it's no different than chelev v'dam. Just like chelev v'dam, you're not allowed to eat. A person's not allowed to drink dam, and a person's not allowed to eat chelev. And despite the fact they go on the mizbeach, so what's the big deal that a gid and asher is going to go on to the mizbeach? Rabbonon say there's a big difference. Mitzvotan bekach, shiny. That's the mitzvah. Their specific demand that the chelev and dam end up on the mizbeach. That's the ikar ha-korban. The way I would have formulated it is, the only reason that chelev and dam are asur for Bnei Yisrael to eat outside of the mikdash is because they do go on the mizbeach inside the mikdash. It's not an isur separate from the korban. It says, don't eat blood, don't eat chelev. The reason we don't eat blood and chelev is because they belong or should have been on the mizbeach. So when you have it in chulin, you're not allowed to eat it. They get separated away. Adam huba nefesh. That's the reason it goes on the mizbeach. That's also the reason you can't eat it. So that's what the Rabbanan say. Dam and chelev are not a good example of something asur that goes on the mizbeach, because there's a specific demand for it. And the truth is, that demand is what makes it asur outside the mikdash. Rabbi says, well, there you go. I have a paradigm of something asur that goes on the mizbeach. And so, gid and asher would also go on the mizbeach. It's no different than chelev and dam. Just like chelev and dam go on the mizbeach, so too the gid and asher subsumed in the Yerech can go on his back, even though it's not me mutar the Israel, even though it's not that which is mutar for Israel to eat. So that lays out a machloket between them, which says that when you have a gid and asher subsumed in a Yerech, does it go on the mizbeach? Which Rabbi says yes. The Chachamim say no, that it doesn't go on the mizbeach. Rabbi will agree that if it was taken out and it's separate, then it doesn't go on the mizbeach. From that, we go back to the machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Chaya Yosef, where Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says, They argue about putting it on the Mizbeach, which means that, according to Rabbi, you can put it on the Mizbeach with the Yerech, which is akin to what Bechir Bar Yosef said, which is there's no din of Gidon Asher by Olot. And the Chachamim's position is that you've got to take that Gid out before you put the Yerech on the Mizbeach. And that'd be akin to what Rabbi Yochanan says, that Gidon Asher is Noeg by the Olah. And then to the Gears of Rashi, that means that they're also arguing about Chalatzot, the necessity to take the Gid out. According to Bechir Bar Yosef, since it can go on inside the Yerech, you don't have to take it out. According to Rabbi Yochanan, who says it can't go on the Mizbeach with the Yerech, you have to Chalatzot, you have to take it out. According to that view, there's also a machloket about Chalatzot, whether you necessity to take it out or not, is akin to the machloket as whether you're allowed to put it on the Mizbeach. And that means Rabbi Bechir Bar Yosef is following that position of Rabbi, and Rabbi Yochanan is following the position of the Chachamim, according to this explanation of Rav Nachman by Yitzchak. The Baal Tosafot are bothered by why the Gemara brought the first Braita at all. The first Braita doesn't add anything. We have Rabbi's opinion in the second Braita. Why bother to bring the first Braita? Other Rishonim are less bothered by that. Like the Ramban says, the Gemara does that all the time. They want to know who authored this position in a Braita. So they'll bring a Braita, and then they'll bring another Braita to show you who the author is. So they're less bothered by the fact that there's a duplication here of the Braita. But the Baal Tosafot are, and therefore the Baal Tosafot suggest over here that the necessity of the first Braita is in order to limit the position of Rabbi and the Chachamim. And he says, because if they didn't have the first Braita, I would have said, according to the Rabbonon, Sheish Rabot Kol Mashnuchal Rabot, we would have gone to the furthest extent to include everything, even things that are Asur. You would have thought all that goes on the Mizbeach. Only thing that doesn't go on Mizbeach is stuff that's popped off the pyre, because that's the end of the Hakrava on the Mizbeach. And Rabbi holds, we would only exclude one thing, which is things that are Asur that separate away. Things that are attached, that are Asur, Pershu, Deatero, Yalu, they would go on the Mizbeach. So according to the Baal Tosafot, the first Braita limits the scope of what you would have thought in Rabbi's position in the second Braita. According to the second Braita, it is a Ribui and a Miut. The question is, where does the Ribui and the Miut end? And you would have thought maybe the Miut is only made one thing, which is something that's separated away, that also was Isur. But something that was attached and was Isur, or something that's separated away and that was had there, maybe all those should go on the Mizbeach. That's what the first Braita comes to teach you, that Gidim Deetera, even when they separate away, they go back down. Similar to the way that the bones of Heter go down. And that limits the scope of Rabbi to say that Rabbi believes anything that separates away goes down. And not just things that are separated away that are Isur, even things that are Heter. So that then tells you that the scope of Rabbi's permission of what you can put on the Mizbeach is limited. And then it does the same thing by the Chachamim's position. Once we know that Rabbi is not including everything he could, also, with regards to the Chachamim, we're not going to include everything we possibly could have included, and therefore we exclude Isura, even if it's Mechubar, not just Isura when it is Mufrash. So again, the first Braita starts to say that don't go to the extreme of what you could have included in terms of what goes on the Mizbeach for Rabbi. And when we pull back on Rabbi, we also pull back on the Chachamim, therefore we'd exclude from things that go on the Mizbeach for Rabbi, even things that are Pershu of Hetera, and for the Chachamim, even things that are Isura, that are Mechubarim. And obviously, if they are Pershu, that they're not going to go on the Mizbeach, and it's not just Pukim that doesn't go back on the Mizbeach. Gemara says, Amar Rav Huna, Gidon Asher Shel Olah, Cholotzo LeTapuach. You take it off and throw it on the Tapuach. The Tapuach, according to most Rishonim, Rashi explains it over here as well, is the pile of ashes that was made in the center of the Mizbeach. Which is that every day after they burnt everything and everything was made into ashes, they used to collect the ashes and the coals and put everything towards the middle of the Mizbeach and build up what was like an apple-looking mound in the middle of the Mizbeach, and that was known as the Tapuach. That Tapuach then was subject to Hotzat Hadeshen. Whereas Trumat Hadeshen was done every day from a small amount from the Maracha, Hotzat Hadeshen was done Makloket Rashi and the Rambam is whether it was done every daily or only when necessary, but it was when they took out the deshen from that tapuach that piled up in the middle, then they used to take it out michutz l'machaneh. So what he suggests is that the Gidon Asher Shel Olah, you have to take it out, but you throw it onto the tapuach. You throw it onto this pile or mound in the middle. There is a view in the Raifut that says that the tapuach was actually a platform on the top of the Mizbeach. And that the Mizbeach was square, but in the center of the Mizbeach, there was a circular platform, and that's what he calls the Tapuach. That's a opinion that we'll see later on in Kodoshim by Masechet Tamid and Masechet Midot, but he's a Dat Yachid amongst the Rishonim who thinks that the Tapuach is part of the Mizbeach, rather than the pile of ashes on top of the Mizbeach. Amar Rav Chisda, Mari Daichi. The absolute translation of the word Dachi in Aramaic is Tahor, and Mar means Mr. or Master, Master Tahor, which would make no sense in this scenario. But it seems to be, as Rashi says over here, Mari Daichi means Baal Shmuazo, the one who made this comment. And he's doing it as an exclamation. The one who made this comment, how could it be that he makes such a comment? Others say it's a reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mari Daichi, the Tahor Master, which is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as if someone says, Ribono Shel Olam, how could you say such a thing? It's an expression that is associated with Rav Chisda. He's the one who uses it in Shas. And when he is perplexed or bothered by the statement of the previous Amora. And here, Rav Huna, he can't understand. Miktiv, Alkein lo yochal ha-mizbeach. It doesn't say by the Gid HaNasheh, therefore the Mizbeach will not eat it. The din of Gid HaNasheh is, Alkein lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael at Gid HaNasheh. That's what's written in Breishit. It's not written there, Alkein lo yochal ha-mizbeach. The Mizbeach won't eat it. So why are you worried about putting the Gid HaNasheh on the Mizbeach? Why can't the Mizbeach eat it? V'Rav Huna, Rav Huna's reason is, Mi Mashkei Yisrael, Mi Mutar Yisrael. He has the pasuk in Yechezkel that says the Mizbeach only accepts things that are acceptable to Bnei Yisrael. Gid HaNasheh is not acceptable for Bnei Yisrael, so that's why it's not going to go on the Mizbeach. Alright, so may debate. Is that really the case? Gid HaNasheh Shel Shlamim. When you have a Gid HaNasheh Ove Shlamim, Mechabdo Le'ama. You sweep it into the sewer system of the Beit HaMikdash. The Amah is the Amata Mayim, which is another term for a water aqueduct. So that is the water that comes into the Mikdash, which they brought in through an aqueduct system from Ein Etam. The Gemara describes in Masechet Yoma, they brought it from a mountain spring that was higher than the Mikdash, and it was a long distance. They brought the water all the way into Yerushalayim. There aren't necessarily natural springs inside of Yerushalayim that are high enough to bring water into the Mikdash. And from an engineering standpoint, the only way you can bring water without pumping it into Yerushalayim to the Mikdash, which is very high up, is bringing them from a water source that is even higher. So they brought an aqueduct system in that brought the water in from outside of Yerushalayim into the Mikdash. And then that water went through the Mikdash and then out the other end of the Mikdash towards the side of the Kidron Valley. And there is the drainage line on the stairs you can see on the southern and eastern excavations. Piping that took the water out of the Mikdash. So it acted both as the water coming into the Mikdash as well as the drainage out, because it kept flowing, flowed in and then flowed out of the Mikdash. And so what you would do is you'd sweep it into that Amah. Vishel Ola Maaleu. And that of an Ola sounds like Maaleu goes on the Mizbeach. Mai Lav Maaleu Umaktiro. Then you put it on the Mizbeach. Sounds like you put it on like regular, like Rav Chisda was suggesting. Lo Maaleu Vicholtso. Bring it up and you take it out. If you are removing the Gid HaNasheh from it, then why are you putting on Mizbeach? If you bring your lowly stuff, your disgusting stuff before Hashem, you think that's what he wants? Do you think that's going to be acceptable? So it would be inappropriate to be menaker to take the Gid out before you brought it up to the Mizbeach. If you brought it up to the Mizbeach already ripped out, you'd have the Yerach would be torn to pieces before you bring it up. That's not appropriate to bring it to the Mizbeach in such a presentation. So what you do is you take it up to the top of the Mizbeach hole, and then at the top of the Mizbeach you do the Nikur there. The truth is, in the end, it still ends up on the Mizbeach, all torn up, but still the idea of the presentation, you're bringing it up and you're only cutting it up at the top of the Mizbeach. But once you cut it up at the top of the Mizbeach, what are you going to do with the Git? You toss it onto the Mizbeach, not onto the Maracha, but you toss it onto the Tapuach that's on top. And that's how Rav Huna will explain it. Tanya Kavate de Rav Huna. Now we have a Braita that explicitly supports Rav Huna's contention. Gid HaNasheh Shel Shlamim Mechabdo Le'ama. Similarly, Gid HaNasheh Ove Shlamim, you sweep it into the Yama. V'shel Ola Chotzo the Tapuach. And that of the Ola, you pull it out and put it on the Tapuach. And then again, that would be exactly what he's saying, that maleu lemizbeach doesn't mean literally on the maracha, it means on the tapuach, which would be the equivalent of the discard pile of the mizbeach. And so, you do it at the top of the mizbeach because of hakriveo, now the pechatecha, that we don't like to bring it up in that presentation that is not nice, even though again, you're going to be end up cutting it up and doing all this on the top of the mizbeach. Maybe it's the equivalent of when they bring it out in the restaurant. They like to bring out a nice big piece for you, and then they cut up the meat in front of you. So even though if they brought it up all cut up, it wouldn't look so presentable. When they bring it out whole, and then they cut it up for you, that's considered to be more appropriate or better etiquette. And similarly with the mizbeach. What's interesting here that Rashi and the Bali Tosfot try to deal with is, why is there a difference between shlamim and olah? What about other korbanot? Why does the Braita only mention shlamim? So Rashi over here says, v'kashali yerech shel shlamim, lama nechtach ba'azara? Why is the yerech of the shlamim cut up in the azara? A shlamim can be eaten b'chol Yerushalayim, anywhere in Yerushalayim. So if you're going to be menakir, the gidon asheh, out of the yerech of the shlamim to be eaten, why would you do it in the azara? Talon nechal b'chol yer. Just do it somewhere else in Yerushalayim. It doesn't make sense that it was done in the azara. You're speaking about sweeping it into the sewer system after you take it out. Why are you even taking it out over there? Venir ve'enai. So he says, first of all, the chatat v'asham gar sinat, shem nechalim b'azara. Says he thinks there's a mistake in the girsa. It shouldn't read shlamim, but rather it should read chatat v'asham, which are korbanot that can only be eaten in the azara, and it would make sense that they're doing the nikur in the azara itself. Inami. He says the other possibility is mishum chazev v'shok shel kohanim. The shok of the shlamim goes to the kohanim. Now, even though the Kohanim themselves are allowed to eat anywhere in Yerushalayim, their gifts from the Shlamim, nevertheless, Agid B'tocho, Barova Achilatam V'Diratam B'Azara. The majority of their time and eating is spent where they live, in the Azara. That's where the Kohanim are when they're serving in the Mikdash. So when they get the Chazev Shok, they're most likely going to eat it in the Mikdash. And that's what the reference to over here is. It says Shlamim, to the gift part of the Kohanim, which contains within it the Gidon Hashem. They took care of it in the Azara, and the Balei Tosafot bring a third possibility, which is Inami, Bishlamim Shel Kohanim. It's a Shlamim of a Kohanim. It's not a Shlamim of Israel. And then, Shekol Kocheim, Ayuriglim Lechol Bazara. So even though Kohanim, again, have permission to eat outside in the ear, since they also have permission to eat in the Azara, when they brought a Shlamim, they ended up eating it in the Azara. That's a third way to deal with this issue of why the Shlamim are mentioned. Now the Gemara says, Nanotom. We have a little digression, which is we have a Mishnah in Tamid. Tapuach ayah b'emtza mizbeach. There was this tapuach in the middle of mizbeach, which again we discuss. Most Mishonim think it is this pile of ashes in the middle. The Raivid who thinks it is a circular platform in the middle of the mizbeach. Pamim ayah lav kishlosh meot kur. There were times that it had 300 kur worth of ashes that were piled up on it. Amarova guzma. That's an exaggeration. It never happened that there were 300 kur. It's just a way to give you a feeling or a sense of how much was there. They use the number 300. The Rashbam in the Gemara of Sakhin says anytime the Gemara of the Mishnah uses 300, it's their chuzma. You should know that. 300 is not an exact number. It's a number that's trying to give you a sense of proportion, trying to give you a sense of the magnitude or the extent to which something is happening. So then, shku et tamid b'kosh sil zahav. They used to give the tamid to drink from a golden cup or goblet to drink water before they shechted it. They gave water to the animals before they shechted them because if the animals drank a lot of water beforehand, it made it much easier to flay them afterwards. So they used to do it for the korban tamid out of a golden cup or a golden goblet. Amarova guzma. That's also an exaggeration. You don't feed animals with golden utensils. It's just they're giving expression to the fact that it's in the Mikdash. They took care of it. It was a korban. Amar Rabbi Yami, Dibra Torah Lashon Habai. The Torah speaks in exaggerations, or a Lashon of Habai really means nothingness or meaningless words. But obviously over here it's a borrowed term to mean guzma. Meaning it's something that's an exaggeration. Dibra Nevi'im Lashon Habai. The Nevi'im also used exaggeration. Dibra Chachamim Lashon Habai. And the Chachamim also used exaggeration. Dibru Chachamim Lashon Havai Hadamran. We already told you. We gave you the cases where the Chachamim expressed something in an exaggeration. Dibru Torah Lashon Havai, that is by Moshe Rabbeinu in Dvarim, when he's giving his speech about the eventual invasion of Eretz Canaan. And what they're going to see there, he says that they have Arim Gidulot, large cities, Ubutzurot Bashamayim, that are fortified until the heavens. It's clear that they're not fortified to the heavens. It just means that they're extremely well fortified. This is what the Ramban picks up on when he's speaking in Parshat Shlach about the report of the Meraglim, saying that they have very well fortified cities and they're strong. And he says, you see that they weren't lying. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he describes the cities, describes them as being fortified to the heavens. And so the Ramban over there is searching for what the Meraglim did wrong if they really told the truth. And the Ramban then focuses in on the word Ephes. Over there, that's the Ramban Shita, but he draws it from the fact that Moshe doesn't give much of a different description than that which the Meraglim gave. He says the people there are Anakim, the cities are well fortified. It's exactly the report that the Meraglim brought back. Dibru Nevi'im Lashon Havai, the Nevi'im also exaggerated, because it says when they go to anoint Adoniyahu as the king without the permission of David, he usurps the kingship because David is incapacitated right now. And he sees himself as being next in line because his two older brothers, Amnon and Absalom, already been killed. And the third brother that's older than him seems was not qualified to be a king. So Adoniyahu is the next in line. And he then takes advantage of the situation to appoint himself the king. And he has many followers in that. And it says there by the celebration, the earth split open from the noise and the tumult of the anointing or the inauguration of Adoniyahu. Obviously, it's not true that the land split open or there was an earthquake or sort, but they use that to describe how much noise was there. It made it sound or feel like there was an earthquake or something earth-shattering that was going on. Amar Rav Yitzchak bar Nachmani Amar Shmuel, Shlosha Mikamot Dibru Chachamim Lashon Havai. There are three places where the Chachamim exaggerated. Now, as Rashi points out and the Baal Tosfot point out, he's actually going to give three, and it's going to be different than what Rava said before. Rava brought two before. Shmuel's statement only incorporates one of Rava's statements, not both of them. And therefore, they say that he argues on Rava's position with regards to the Kos Shel Zahav. Rava said the Kos Shel Zahav was Havai, or was a Derech Kuzma, was an exaggeration. According to Shmuel, it was not an exaggeration. And they did give the Korban Tamid to drink from a golden cup. That's because Ein Aniyut B'Makom HaShirut. The Mikdash is a place of royalty, and everything that's done there is done before Hashem, as if it was the palace of the king. And in the palace of the king, they give the animals to drink too from golden cups. And therefore, in an iyut makom hashirut, even the utensils used to feed the korban tamid were made out of gold. And so therefore, he disagrees with Rav over there about it being a guzma, and he says actually that's what they did. He does agree with Rav's other statement, and then adds on two more. Shlosha mikamot dibru chachamim lashon havai ve'elohein. Tapuach, which is what we saw before. Gefen uparochet. Tapuach had amran. We already described it. Defen, the grapevine, it's none. This is a Mishnah that describes the first Eitz HaChaim, like they have in all the shuls all over the world. They have an Eitz HaChaim where you can donate a branch, a leaf, you can donate the trunk. That's for the shul. This was the first one, and it was in the Beit HaMikdash. Defen shel zavav hayta umedet al pitcho shel heichal. There was this golden grapevine that was at the entranceway to the heichal. Umudla gabalei klonosot. And it was hung over these poles, or basically it was on trellises. There were trellises holding up this golden vine. Anybody who donated either a single grape or a whole bunch of grapes, he would bring it, and he was able to hang it on the, quote-unquote, Eitz HaChaim, on the gefen. There was a time when they had to bring in 300 Kohanim in order to lift it, to move it out, or to show it to the people. It had gotten so big and so heavy that it required 300 Kohanim to lift it. So there he's saying that that's their kuzma. It wasn't literally that there were 300 people. It was that it was very heavy. It had gotten extremely large. And then he describes it as being something that required 300 Kohanim to take it out. Different approaches to why they used the gefen, whether it's because Torah is Nimshalah the Geffen, or whether it's because B'nai Yisrael is Nimshalah the Geffen, or is it because the Avot are Nimshalu the Geffen, and that to bring in Zuchut Avot. That's why they made a Geffen or a vine in the Mikdash, rather than a Eitz HaChaim, quote unquote. This was their Eitz HaChaim, but they picked a Geffen in particular,
because of its representative meaning and the relationship between Bnei Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Parochet, it's not. The parochet, because we have a Mishnah. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Mishum Rabbi Shimon Askan, parochet uvya tefach. It was a tefach wide, val shivim ushnayim nirim nereget. And it was woven on 72 strands, val kol nima v'nima esrim v'arba chutim. And every string that was used for the weave was made out of 24 ply. That is because there are four materials that are used to make the parochet: sheish, argaman, tchelet, and tulat shani. And the Gemara in Yoma tells us that each one of those materials was 6 ply. So if you have 4 materials that are 6 ply, that makes it 24 ply in every string, which is the combination of those 4 materials. So now you have, in the weaving process, 72 strands. And each strand consisted of 24 ply threads. So you can imagine it was pretty thick, as it mentions over here, that it was an amah thick. Orka, its length was 40 be'amah. Virochba, and its width was 20 be'amah, 20 amot. So now Rashi over here quotes 2 possibilities. One possibility is that it was for the petach ha'ulam, the entranceway into the antechamber before the echal, because the petach to the ulam is 40 high, 20 wide, and this filled in the space for 40 high, 20 wide, and that's why the parocha was this size. That's what Rashi says, kach shamati, that's Masorah Her. Bali Nira, he says, I think it is the parocha Ratzvir. It's even the parocha that entered into the Kodesh was that size. And now, even though when it comes to the doorway to the Dvir, it was 20 amot wide by 20 amot high, so then why do you need 40 amot high? He says, because you had to reach up to the Aliyah above. It had to reach to the Govom in Aliyah Vaderitzpa. From the upper chamber down to the ground was the 40 amot. So it wasn't just the 40 amot to take care of the doorway. The 40 amot means that it was hanging from all the way above and down. So even though the doorway itself was only 20 by 20, the parochet was 40 high and 20 wide. So Rashi says that it was for the Dvir, for the Kodesh, not necessarily just for the Ulam, the parochet over here. Umshmonim v'shtayim ribo naset, and it was made from 820,000. Now over here it doesn't tell you what the 820,000 references to. If you look in Rashi, it says 820,000 chutim, that there were 820,000 strings in here. Lishnach rina is that the word is not rebo, but rather revolt, which are na'arot oskotba, young maidens that did this. The work of the weaving was done by young maidens, and specifically revolt, which were young girls, had yet to reach the time when they menstruate, so that there wouldn't be a problem of tuma with regards to the parochet. And therefore it's shmonim ushtayim revolt. There were 82 revolt that were working on it, because they were the main weavers in the Mikdash. And in particular, they used revolt in order to avoid the problems of tuma. So that would be the other way to explain it. There is a third possibility, which the Rambam in the Perush Mishnayot over there says that it was from 820,000 dinare zahav. That was the cost putting this parochet together. V'shtayim oseh b'shana. You make them twice a year. It's not clear here why you needed to make them twice a year. It could be what Rashi says over here, which is that they needed 2. One for the petach ulam, and one for the petach ha'advir. Or the possibility is that in the second Beit HaMikdash, we know that between the Kodesh and the Kodesh Kodeshim, there were 2 parochot that the Kohen Gadol was able to walk between them. That was to mean Shtayim Bishana. There were the 2 parochot that stood between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And that also would be favored by the Balei Tosafot's description that it's called the Zakot al Aron, that parochet will hang over the Aron, which means Zim to indicate it's the parochet between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, and not just the parochet of the Petach HaUlam, or even the Petach HaDvir, but rather the parochet that sits between the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim. And that's why you needed 2 a year, because they form that division, which was created not by 1 parochet, but by 2 parochot over there. Whereas others just suggest that they had to turn it over twice a year because of the Ashana Ktoret. The smoke that was always in the Mikdash, it eventually made the parochot dark or blackened them, and therefore they had to change them over because of the blackening of the parochet. And that's why they had to replace it twice a year. Shlosh meot kohanim matbilin ota. And 300 kohanim are needed to put it into the mikveh.
Rashi says, kashin imit, it's mate. When it became tamei, if you needed to put in the mikveh, you needed 300 kohanim to do it, because you can imagine something of that size and that thickness, if you put it into the water, when it was waterlogged, it would be extremely heavy and hard to take out. That's why you need 300 kohanim. But again, he's saying that that's derech kuzma. It didn't literally require 300 kohanim, but rather it was a third of the exaggerations that are mentioned in the Mishnah. You can see in each of these cases that the number 300 is used, so that is a good indication, like the Rashbam says, that 300 is something that is a manner of exaggeration. Others suggest that it's only a derech hapshat, that it's biguzma, but if you really look at it by derech haremez or derech hasod, 300 is significant, like we always see in the Maharal, who takes numbers very seriously. He will then take these numbers and say that there is significance to 300. It has meaning besides just the, on the surface, what looks like a derech kuzma. The Gral actually tries to calculate that why you would need 300 kohanim over here is based on the fact that the parochet was 40 by 20, which means that the perimeter of the parochet was 120 amot around. And if you use 120 amot times an amah of 5 tefachim, then would equal 600 tefachim. A tefach is a handful or a fistful. So if you have 600 tefachim of perimeter all around, then it would take 300 kohanim to hold it with two hands to take it out. That's the gross calculation over here, and that's why he says they needed 300, although others dispute the fact that it should be 5 tefachim, because yes, the kelim in the mikdash had a din of 5 tefachim, but the binyan was made out of an amah of 6 tefachim. And since the parochet is part of the binyan, it would be made out of 6 tefachim amot and not 5 tefachim amot. If you have 6 times 120, that's 720 tefachim, and then your calculation doesn't work out. But that's the way for the Gra to try to come up with a reason for the 300 tefachim. The last thing you have to deal with is, why did it need to go to the mikveh? So Rashi says it's because it became tameh. Bali Tosfon want to know, how does it become tameh? It's part of the binyan, then it's not subject to tumah. It's only subject to tumah, a vilon, or a separator, a parochet, is only subject to tumah when it can be wrapped around a person or used as a piece of clothing. But otherwise, it doesn't have a din of tumah. So then, why over here would you require a tvila? The lekalameimar, don't say, kevin de nerga ayumat bilimota. As soon as they finish weaving it, they used to put it in the mikveh. The kelim anigmarim bitara, tzrichim tvila lekodesh. Because even kelim that are made bitara, they require one dip in the mikveh in order to be taken into the world of kodesh. Because that's only when you're speaking about kelim that are mikabel tumah. But when you're dealing about something that's not mikabel tumah, you won't need to put it in the mikveh. The Rosh disagrees, and the Rosh brings down this first position that Bais Tosfot reject, and say that they were being matpilit for letara in order to bring it into the Kodesh. And then the Tosfot is even more bothered by the fact that the Mishnayot and Shkalim seem to indicate that it does become tamei. And therefore the Bais Tosfot in the end come to the conclusion, yesh tamar, the mikabel tumah l'fishuhu ohel, because it acts and functions like an ohel, because the parochet is said to be sakota al aron. It hangs over, it hovers over the aron. The kayif le mikaf ilavei daron. That they used to fold it over or tilt it a little bit so that it covered the aron in order to accomplish the pasuk that says sakota al aron. So even though it was used as a separating parochet at the top was folded over so that it would then hover over the aron itself to be also sakota al aron. Once it's an ohel, it can be mikabel tumah, like an ohel, not like a vilon that separates between, but rather like an ohel, and that's how it could become tamei. So that's the way Tosfot does it. The Rosh suggests that maybe they were afraid that even though they used young girls who had yet to reach the point of nida, that maybe during that period of time that they were working, they became or they began to menstruate, so they were worried about it possibly becoming tamei tumat nida, and then just because of that chashash, they were matvilit before they started. So there are the Rishonim are trying to figure out why exactly it is that it was Tamei. The Rosh favors saying that it was the initial initiation of the Parochet that demanded the Tvila. Rashi over here says when it becomes Tamei, although he never explains to you why or how it could become Tamei. The Bais Tosfot, in struggling with that, comes to the conclusion that it has a din of Ohel, and that's how it could become Tamei, and that's why it would require Tvila. Right now, the Gemara continues with what's said in the Mishnah, which is, v'yerach shel yamin v'yerach shel shmol, that the Gidon HaShe applies to both the right and left legs of the animal, And you have Rabbi Yehuda's dissenting opinion, which is that it only applies to one of the two, and that's what the Gemara says now. Matznita and Deloka Rabbi Yehuda. Our Mishnah is clearly not authored by Rabbi Yehuda. Titania, because we have in the Tosefta, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Einu Noheg Ela Ba'achat. It's only Noheg in one of the two legs. Vadat Machrat et Shel Yamin. And it seems logical that it would be the right side. So now, Ibayiluhu, Mifshat Pshitale, the Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda is clear that it is the right one, meaning that the one of the two has the Gidanash in it. And he says it makes sense it should be the right leg that has it. Is that a determination? Is he saying definitively that that is the case? Because of my dat, dat Torah. And that's what he learns from the Torah. When he says that dat machrat, doesn't mean a logical statement. He says it means that the Torah is machriya, that it should be the right side, and we'll see why. Odilma spuke misapkale. Or maybe he is uncertain. My dat, dat nota. What does it mean that it should be? It means that logically, I would have assumed it's the right side. Tashma, let's try to figure this out. Hatsamot, vagidim, vanotar, yisrufu l'shisha asar. When it comes to the leftovers of the Korban HaPesach, the bones, the gidim, and anything that else that's left over has to be burnt on the 16th. The reason it's not burnt on the morning of the 15th is because it's Yom Tov. And you're not allowed to be soreif kodoshim on Yom Tov. So it has to wait until the morning of the 16th. Vabinan ba. Hane gide ma vidayu. Why are these gidim requiring sreifa? Why do they have to be burnt? Igide basar. If they were gidim that were edible, lichlinu. Why didn't they eat them on the night of Pesach? Vidi aitur. If they were left over, I mean, yes, they had them, they were basar, they just ended up eating them, then haino notar. How's that any different than notar of basar? Basar that's left over gets burnt. So does gidim if they are edible like basar. They're also called notar. Why would you segregate them away from the notar? Ela gide de tzavar. We're speaking about the sinews of the neck, which are very hard, and they're not edible. Ilav basar ninu. If they're not edible and they're not classified as basar, lishtinu. Just throw them in the garbage. You don't have to do anything with them. If they're not edible, then they're not subject to the din of achilat korban pesach. And then they don't have any din of notar that they have to be burnt afterwards. So why are you burning them? Bamrav chista lo nitzvacha lelegida nasheh. I'll leave it to Rabbi Yehuda. The only reason we need the Gid to be mentioned there is Rabbi Yehuda's Shita about Gid and Hashem. Damar Neinu Hegel Abachat, because he says it only applies to one of the two legs. Iyamart Bishlama Spuke Misapkelei Shapir. If Rabbi Yehuda's position is a Safek, then I understand what's going on over here. Because you have two legs. I'm not sure which one has the Gid and Hashem in it, so I can't eat either of them. One of the two is, one of the others is not. That means one of them is edible and is basar, one of them is not. So I don't know, so I can't eat it, but that means I also have to burn it. Because one of those two also is subject to notar because it was edible. And that's the reason that you would have a gid that has to be burnt afterwards. Eliyam art mishap shitale, deetera lechle, disur leshadje. If he knows for certain that the right leg is the one that's problematic and the left leg is okay, then in that situation, the right leg you would throw in the garbage because it's not subject to achilah, and therefore it doesn't have a din of kushat. Korban HaPesach doesn't require to be burnt as notar. And the one that is edible on the left side, either you eat it, and if you don't eat it, it's notar, like any other notar, and you would burn in the morning. So then, if you know which one it is, there's no reason to have to burn a gid separate from notar, or independent of what you have by notar. If you say it was a safek, I understand the problem. I have two gidim here. One of them should have been eaten, one of them can't be eaten. So I can't eat them, but I also would then need to burn them as notar because of that. So that's why the Gemara says it must be that he didn't conclude it was a safek. Amar Avika bar Chanina lo la mim lecha misha pshitale. Now maybe he does know. V'ocha b'may eskinan. The case here is shehukru olasof nitarvo. They first of all knew which one was the right and left, and then they got mixed up. As Rashi says over here, it's lav dafka. They didn't necessarily have to know ahead of time which was which. It's just they lost track of which one was the right kid and which one was the left kid. Now that they're confused, they don't know what to do. They can't eat it because one of them is a sore. They can't not burn it because one of them was good for achila and then is subject to notar. So for that reason, it's a problem. So even if Rabbi Yehuda knew which one was a sore and which one was mutar, there's a possibility that people would run into a problem even knowing which one when they get them mixed up and they don't know which one's the right and which one's the left legs get in a shit. So therefore, we have nothing conclusive from this braita. Rav Ashi Amar,
lo nitzrachai lo sham. No. Vashi says we can explain the brayta differently, which is we only need the brayta to tell you about the shuman, the fat that surrounds the gidin asher. The tanya, shamno mutar, the fats that surround the gidin asher are totally mutar. Yisrael kadoshim nagubo isur. And B'nai Yisrael who are kadoshim have a minog to treat it with isur. They don't want to get anywhere near the gidin asher. So not only do they not eat the gidin asher, they don't even eat the fat that is around the gidin asher. But that's not me, Ikar Adin. Ikar Adin, the fat around the Gidon Hashem is mutar. Mido right there is an edible item. That means it's subject to Kedushat Korban HaPesach, and it is notar, and you're going to have to burn it afterwards. And that's what's being mentioned in the Mishnah. The Gid that's mentioned in the Mishnah, not the Gid itself, means the fats around the Gid. And the fats around the Gid, even though if you know which Gid it is, and if you know that the Gid is Asur, the Gid is mutar, nevertheless, the fats around the Gid that is Asur, they treat as Isur, so they don't eat it. But it's Minadorite that is good basar, and you would have to then burn it as notar. And it's a big chiddush over here, which is that even though we know that the Chachamim have the power to uproot a Dindoraita b'sheva altaseh, that's when there's a Takanat Chachamim or Gzeirat Chachamim, like not violating Dinei Derabanan to blow the shofar in Rosh Hashanah Shechal b'Shabbat. Or we don't blow it because Shema Yavirenu Dalem Ope Shuta Rabin. All those are upending a din d'oraita b'sheva al taseh. That's because there's a takanat chachamim. What you see over here is that even a minag Yisrael is strong enough to upend a din d'oraita b'sheva al taseh if, of course, it is a proper minag and proper conduct. And you see that over here. That B'nai Yisrael were knowing Yisrael by the fats around the Gidin Hashem. For that reason, they didn't eat it by the Korban HaPesach, even though there's a mitzvah to eat the basar of the Korban HaPesach. And that's what the Gid is. That's notar. Ravina Amar lo nitzrachai lo k'Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. We need for Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Shnei Gidim. There are two sinews over there. There's two Gidim. Hein Pnimi, Samuch Le'etzim. The internal one that's close to the bone, that is a sword. That is the Gidin Hashem. V'chayavin alav. And then if you ate that one, you'd be chayav malkot. Chitzon, Samuch Le'basar. There's an outer one that is closer to the flesh. Asur, it's still asur, but ain't chayvin alav. It's only asur mid rabbanan. It's not asur mid oraita. And that is what's going on over here. The one that's asur mid oraita, of course, you can just throw it out. That's not a problem. The one that's only asur mid rabbanan, mid oraita, it's good enough to be eaten for the Korban HaPesach. That means that it's no tar with regards to the Korban HaPesach, even though it's asur mid rabbanan to eat it. And therefore, there's an isur mid rabbanan on that outer gid. And that's what we're speaking about in the Braita. And we'll speak about this issue of the inner and outer gid when we get to it on Sadi Gimel. We'll discuss then what the location or the exact location of the inner and outer gid. But according to all three of these answers, either the case where it got mixed up, or we're speaking about the fats around the gid, or we're speaking about the inner and outer gid, then in all those instances, the restriction, either because of safek, or because there's a minag Yisrael not to eat the fats, or because there's an issur de rabbanan to eat the outer gid, all those are qualified midoraita to be Korban HaPesach. And that's why if they're left over, you're going to have to burn them because they are considered to be notar. Independent of regular notar, these are notar because their isur is only either an isur derabanan, a minog, or because of a safek. And that'll explain the din and the braita. But then again, we're left without a conclusion as to whether Rabbi Huda believes that there was a determination about the Gidin Hashem here, or whether it's a safek. And then we'll have to continue tomorrow to bring other bright oath to figure out what Rabbi Yehuda's position is. We're going to stop here, seven lines down on the top of Tzadi Aleph and Aleph, and we'll also discuss tomorrow